capable of doing that and moving him very far, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I should send you a picture of one of these. K2RIW, K2J. Actually, what you're describing is sort of there, but it's actually out in the open, the way it's mounted in the board. And you can remove it very easily. You take it out, put it back, and it operates exactly the same frequency. I tried shunting it, a few other things, and it would stop oscillating right away. So the last thing I tried, it seems to work. I almost got it to the 100 megahertz difference that I was looking for. I took a very fine grit sandpaper and started eroding it. Not like I made a whole lot of dust, but just a little bit. It seems to go up. But I haven't tested it as far as temperature stability because it's going to be outside. So I was just hoping that you had some good answers for me.
In some cases, the resonator is sitting alongside a piece of microstrip line, and depending on the way it's mounted, it has a certain coupling coefficient to that microstrip line. As you bring a frequency tuning device nearby, the good news is you're changing the resonant frequency. The bad news is you're changing the coupling coefficient between the microstrip line and the resonator. So in theory, you have to do a double tuning characteristic. You have to change the way the microstrip line couples to the resonator at the same time you're changing the tuning frequency by with your external tuning device. So the stopping of oscillation in some cases is because your tuning device was really changing the coupling coefficient. That's what I think was going on. And if you could understand the mode of resonance and the mode of coupling, those field lines, so to speak, it might help you to know how you should be shifting things in order to do what you desire. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Yeah, KQRIW, KQEJ. I have a friend in England who's been doing this and seems to be successful at it. I'm trying to get my take on it or my try. Got to remember these things are manufactured as cheaply as possible. There actually is no tuning device on it. It's just a fixed assembly. So, I tried changing the reactors, changed coupling around it, and every time I try, I fail. Or it doesn't oscillate. Or it didn't move. And the only thing that seems to have an effect is if I change the physical dimension of the face of it. It looks like a little pill. Even when you get the oil from your fingers on it, it doesn't seem to affect it. So, that's what I was looking for. And there was something else I was going to say. Right. It'll come to me later. All right, thanks for that little tidbit. And by the way, I've got a 12 gigahertz transmitter and receiver, that has your name on it, and I just have to get them to you.
I guess I ought to drop into your place of business one of these days. Sounds good. In the case of a quartz crystal, the oscillation of the quartz crystal is a mechanical phenomenon. The piezoelectric means that you apply voltage and the crystal distorts in some way. It bends, it tilts, and whatever. So putting a fingerprint on a quartz crystal or rubbing some pencil lead on it changes its mechanical resonant frequency. A dielectric resonator oscillator does not mechanically move. The signal is bouncing around inside of the dielectric resonator as if it was a completely closed cavity, a sealed metallic box. The dielectric resonator is so high in dielectric constant, quite often numbers like 100. In other words, it has 100 times lower impedance than free space. So the signal, once it's launched inside of the dielectric resonator, the signal is bouncing around in there, very similar to the way the signal bounces around inside your microwave oven. So what you do to the outside by putting on fingerprints and grease and whatever almost doesn't matter. Because the grease you put on the outside, the fingerprint and so on, has a dielectric constant of 3. You added that to a resonator that has a dielectric constant of 100. You haven't even touched it, if you know what I mean. You haven't changed its electrical length. So grinding it with a lapping technique, I think, is going to give you a best approach, Eric. But you got to make sure that you haven't created a tilt. In other words, don't grind the 12 o'clock position more than the 6 o'clock position, if you know what I mean. Keep the surfaces perfectly parallel, perfectly smooth with your grinding process. And as long as the dimension that you're decreasing with your grinding process, as long as that dimension...
Repeater, time out.
As long as that dimension is the critical dimension that created the resonance, then you're going to be moving it. If the resonance is a radial resonance, in other words, if the signal is starting at the center and propagating in a radial manner of the circular puck out to the perimeter and then reflecting back, if that's the mode of resonance, then you changing the height of the cylinder is not going to do it. So you have to go one step further to find out what are those field lines like inside of that resonating puck. I mean, if it's the second method of resonance that I just described, you have to change the circumference. You have to change the diameter in order to adjust the resonant frequency in that case. And that would be a tough one. I hope it's the first one. So by some means, you'll eventually find out how those feed lines bouncing around inside of that resonator. They probably call it the TE111 circular mode, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I have enough of these to be able to destroy a couple of them, but it seems like if I remove some of the surface from either the top or the bottom, it does go up higher in frequency. Oh, by the way, the thing that I wanted to say before, in terms of duplexes, or even antenna-wise, what is acceptable? You set it up at 50 ohm system, exactly 50 ohms, and you get 100 dB of isolation. You're hooking into a real system. You know, what in the real world is acceptable? I mean, do you need to be able to get one-tenth of a microvolt? Or the difference of two or three-tenths of a microvolt in the receiver side? Does that really matter? I mean, at some point when you're dealing with signals that weak and you're doing a repeater, you know, how much additional coverage are you going to get from that? Is it worth it to try and get that perfect 100 dB of isolation? And I just don't think there's a limit in terms of what we need to do in the real world. K2RIW, K2EJ.
I've got a different opinion than that one, Eric. In order to make the numbers round out nicely, let's assume that my repeater was running 1,000 watts. State-of-the-art repeater. And I, for some reason, had permission to run 1,000 watts.
Nobody does that.
Except that. I'm choosing these numbers so that the numbers come out round. Let me drop them. 1,000 watts is plus 60 dBm. And so I've converted the power back into decibels of 1.2 milliwatts. Plus 60 dBm. If I had 100 dB of isolation in this perfectly tuned duplexing filter, plus 60 dBm, 100 dB of isolation, means the leakage signal is minus 40. So when my transmitter is on, the receiver is getting a minus 40 dBm transmitter signal into the front end of the receiver. When the receiver is trying to have a sensitivity of minus 120 dBm. So I've got a signal 80 dB above threshold coming into that receiver from my own transmitter in that case with 100 dB of isolation. Particularly if I'm using a low noise amplifier in order to try to get state-of-the-art sensitivity out of that repeater. Can that low noise amplifier tolerate an extraneous signal 600 kCOA on the case of 2 meters, which is 80 above threshold, 60 dB above threshold, a minus 40 dBm signal? Can it tolerate that without desensitization? And if I'm measuring the sensitivity of the receiver, and I do it with the transmitter turned on and turned off, and when the transmitter is turned on, my sensitivity changes by 3 dB. At first you'd say, oh, big deal. Well, 3 dB of desense tells me that I've got a certain amount of limiting going on somewhere in that receiver chain. When limiting is going on, I've got nonlinearity. And now if any other extraneous signal comes along, and I've got that nonlinearity that's creating 3 dB of compression, it's going to mix all of those signals together in various techniques. Therefore, my spurious response of my system, which is now mounted on top of a building, which has got a zillion other repeaters nearby, I'm going to have a tremendous amount...
Repeater, time out.
I'm going to have a tremendous amount of vulnerability. of extraneous signals in that rich environment giving me grief. So if this is the best of all worlds, I'd love to get 120 dB of isolation in my duplexing filter. Very carefully tuned, installed environment. Many of these duplexing filters with six cavities can give you close to 100 dB of isolation. If you have the smarts and the instrumentation that can do that, is it worth the effort? Because of what I just described, I think the answer is yes. Particularly if you don't have less, if you have anything less than perfect shielding on all of your equipment in that cabinet, and particularly if you're trying to use a low noise preamplifier in that repeater system in order to get state-of-the-art sensitivity. KE2EJ, K2LIW, that was a bunch of opinions.
Hi, K2RW, K2J. From a theoretical point of view, you're perfectly right, and I perfectly understand that. But most duplexes aren't rated to handle more than 350 watts. That's the biggest I've ever seen. I have actually seen a ham put a kilowatt into it, and you can see what happens to the little loop that's in the damn duplexes. But that's another story. But, you know, in terms of the real world, in terms of real practicality, most repeaters don't run more than 100 watts, so, you know. I think there's a real world practicality in terms of what you're trying to do. I mean, if that's the case, you could use more cavities in your duplex. There's nothing stopping you from doing that, but then you also have to suffer through the loss of yours that you've got. Anyway, move on. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, let me readjust those numbers then. A 100 watt repeater plus 50 dBm with a nearly perfect 100 dB of isolation that my own transmitter comes leaking to my receiver plus 50, minus 100 is minus 50. A minus 50 dBm signal at the transmit frequency is going to go roaring into that receiver. And I like the receiver to have a sensitivity of minus 120. So I've got a signal 70 dB above receiver threshold, roaring into that receiver. Many cases when I turn that transmitter on and off while I'm doing a receiver sensitivity test at the antenna port, I'm probably going to see some fraction of a dB or a number of dB of desensitization when that transmitter is turned on and off. A signal 70 dB above threshold coming into your receiver. No, it's a 600 kc away. On many a receiver, that's going to give you some grief, particularly if there's a low noise amplifier added to it. So to try to tune for all that extra isolation is, if you have the smarts and the ability to do it, I think it's worth seeking, Eric. Now, will the duplexing filter be able to keep that? If you do that careful tweaking, will it still be there a month downrange with all the temperature cycling and humidity cycling and everything else in that particular environment? Hopefully that duplexing filter is going to be in a nice air-conditioned, constant temperature environment. If it's in a cabinet that's mounted outside on the top of a building, oh boy, you're in a lot of trouble. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I agree with you. Although, you know, what is the difference going to be in a commercial installation versus what's the difference going to be in an amateur situation? I mean, the repeaters that we're currently using in the repeater zoom, put a thermometer on those cans and you'll find that there's barely a degree of change in temperature and how it affects the individual. You know, how well whether it's a high pass, low pass, or a notch, going to have different responses at different temperatures. There's no question about that. But I do think that there's a practical limit that you're going to run into. How much is the system going to have a relatively on-frequency, low-visual antenna, and you're using the commercially available devices where, you know, the impedance is going to be close. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be nearby. So, you know, are we losing or are we gaining? Are we losing, say, 2 or 3 dB in terms of, return loss, or is it going to be a fraction of that in each part of the system? I mean, what's practical? Yeah. What's perfect is perfect. There's no argument there. But now, do I need to be able to get a signal that's going to pass through this? Now, forget about the intermod issue. Well, that's a whole other story in terms of the environment and where your antenna is mounted. you know, what's acceptable in the real world of coverage. Yeah, hams want to get the most coverage possible out of it, whereas it's, in the commercial world, you have a service area, and that's not going to be ridiculous like hams want.
There are a very small number of ham radio repeater installations in good locations where, with careful tuning, they achieved a tenth of a microvolt of sensitivity at the antenna port. That's minus 127 dBm.
Yeah, but that's not going to be, you know, 12 dB synod or 20 dB for quieting.
Okay, these guys that claim 0.07 microvolt, let me call it a tenth of a microvolt. Are you telling me that a tenth of a microvolt of sensitivity for 20 dB of quieting, are you saying that that is not achievable, Eric? I've had a couple of people whose opinion I trust claim that they got there on a good day. A tenth of a microvolt, minus 127 dBm I presume, at least 10, maybe 20 dB of noise quieting. Over to you, Eric.
Well, in my experience, I got a little bit of a tough time believing that. Now, I've worked with a lot of commercial stuff. I mean, the receivers that we're working with here, you're lucky if you get 20 dB of quieting with maybe 0.25 to 0.3. Depends on the receiver and how tightly you tune it. And by the way, if the temperature isn't constant, you know it moves around a little bit.
So, a quarter of a microvolt, I think you're saying, with careful tuning, is achievable most days of the week. So, with a very well-tweaked system, I think you're saying you believe that a tenth of a microvolt, when people claim it, I think you're saying you don't believe it. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, I have a hard time with that. I haven't seen things that, you know, I've heard people claim, 0.05, and it's like, I can't see it, because if you look at the noise figures of the front-end transistors that are being used in the stuff that we hams use, that aren't necessarily gas fets or anything like that, I have a tough time with it.
And I presume that a six-cavity duplexing filter system, well-tuned, is going to have close to 1.5 dB of insertion loss between the antenna port and the receiver. Are those numbers approximately right, Eric? Go ahead.
That's a very high-quality duplexing filter, yes. Where is it? I used to have a lot better than the DX. Those things aren't around anymore. I don't remember who bought them, but Wacom's are pretty nice. But we're still talking about, you know, 15.5, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, if you've got a full-size cavity on each one of those cavities where they haven't skimped on the sides, use high-quality materials, roughly a half a dB of loss per cavity. You're going for three cavities on the receiver side, three cavities on the transmitter side, half a dB per cavity, 1.5 dB total, when everything is really humming just right, is achievable. And so, 0.1 microvolt, minus 127 dBm, compared to minus 114 per megacycle, is that achievable with a 15 kc noise equivalent bandwidth? I think it is. You've got around a dB of noise figure in that front end with a good gas fed front end. It is, the numbers say it is close to achievable. Can you really maintain it? But in that environment, I'd love to have a lot more than 100 dB of isolation if I can get it, because that minus 50 dBm signal into my receiver, I know it's going to create some amount of descent. A tenth of a dB, is it 1 dB, is it 2 dB? Any amount of measurable descent is a certain level of non-linearity in that receiver. And if there is the slightest amount of non-linearity in that receiver, obvious by the descent taking place, you know you're going to get extraneous mixing. If you're in a rich environment on top of a building with a whole bunch of other repeaters nearby, let me drop this. And if every one of those other repeaters doesn't have a perfectly operating circulator on every one of those transmitters, boy, you're going to get all kinds of funny effects depending on what time of the day you're operating your repeater. Your other things are going to come roaring through. You've lived through an awful lot of that in your life, Eric. KE2EJ, because some of your repeaters are in a very rich environment. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, I got to admit that Elliot, who owns the
the places where the repeaters are, except for where I am, it's required that every repeater actually has a circulator on it. Every transmitter has a circulator on it. But being up as high as it is, and by the way, we do actually have a little mixing products that go on upstairs. That's why the output PO and the input PO are different on this particular. And it turns out that that's a combination of five different transmitters all being on at the same time, and two of those transmitters are not in the same facility, but they're close by. So, and there's nothing that I can do about those two. You know, if I could eliminate one of them, I could eliminate the problem, but it's just not going to go away.
I can see why you've got a different PO frequency on the output and the input. What is the main reason why there is a PO frequency at all on the output frequency, Eric? Is that to make sure that the, everybody else's receiver doesn't hear anything else except the W2VO over UKGIW?
Now, typically in every other environment, which includes Sheldon and here, the output PO is the same as the input PO, so... Yeah, that gives you the ability to just listen to us. Why W2VL has, you know, we have other places where we want to know when the transmitter is on and off, and just W2VL, that the devices that are listening to it are listening to the output PL. So there's actually a reason for it, other than what most people would think.
I can see that. If you have a completely automatic receiving function that hears everything that goes through the repeater, and you occasionally get a band opening, where Frenchtown, New Jersey has a 146.85, and Torrington, Connecticut has a 146.85 repeater, with band openings, you periodically are going to be recording those other repeaters. You don't really care about recording those, so it just represents a whole lot of grief. So to have an output PL frequency with a receiver recording system that only listens for that particular output PL, I can see that's the advantage. Is that part of the reason, Eric, K2LAW?
As you always say, give that man a cigar. Actually, you've got another repeater in Pennsylvania that has no PL on it.
Not a good reason. Give us the latest word, Eric, on ASC3. Has anything changed in the last week or two as to... how all of our channel numbers are going to change, our method of transmitting digital television is going to change, 2K, 4K, whatever. Have any further decisions from the Friendly Candy Company and other smart people? Is all of this digital television over-the-air broadcast still going to change significantly in the next couple of years, KE2EJ, K2IW?
Actually, there's been quite a bit of movement in actually the past month. The FCC is just about to put their stamp of approval on the final standard. Got an organization called Sinclair, which is about to get double in size if the Department of Justice allows it. They're in the process of buying a Tribune. And they're going to be the first ones to go ATSC very fast. They have multiple stations in multiple markets. And they're already planning on, I think at the end of this year, to have several of them up and running. The standard allows for an activity. It allows for your cell phone to be able to pick it up. Of course, with the later version of cell phones, it will have the receivers on them. It also has the ability to put a small antenna on your car and drive around town and watch television, which is, like, ridiculous. But, you know, this... That would be why you're watching TV unless you've got a self-driving car. Even then, that's kind of a dangerous proposition. But there's also ancillary services that are going to be provided. And they're actually going to have an encryption service which will be allowed. So you can get web page information out of it. You'll be able to put a little thing into your computer and get service that way. There's back channels that will go through the internet and Wi-Fi and a whole lot of other things. So an expandable format, and it's capable of even handling 8K. K2RIW, K2J.
So Sinclair is going to be the first. Make a rough guess, Eric. Are they going to be on the air, maybe in the metro New York area, a year from now, 2 years from now? What's your guess as to how soon over-the-air Sinclair ASC3 digital new standard broadcast will be available? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Well, in terms of New York, that all depends upon whether or not they buy Tribune, because there are no Sinclair stations in the New York metro area. And I don't want to get into the political aspect of Sinclair, because they're an extremely conservative station that does things that I don't agree about, but that's politics. That's a whole another game. But currently now, there's two on the APSC3 station. One's in Washington, and I think another one's just outside of Chicago. I'm not sure about that one. I know that the station down in Atlanta is planning to go. They're ready to go. And there's one in Washington, D.C. that has been on the air, that's been the experimental station, and I think they're waiting for the final license to come through. And a lot of these places, they have channel sharing agreements, just like NBC sold the Channel 4 space, so there is no NBC transmitter anymore. It'll be part of NJU. I mean, they're currently at Empire. They're moving to World Trade for whatever it is. It's by the end of 2019, that will go off the air and be gone. So there's a lot of movement going on right now. And PBS also has put out a infomercial for within the stations themselves, all about ATSC3. YWK2J.
I read the article you shipped me last week, or week before. A significant number of people have already bought a television receiver system that has either 2K or 4K capability. How difficult will it be for those people to adapt to the new ESC COFDM transmitting standard? Is that just a matter of plugging in a new computer program to that television set that they've already purchased? Or do they really have to buy a new front end that they hook up to it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
It depends upon who you bought and when you bought it. All of the current ones are capable of doing QAM now because they're cable ready. You can, and they also have cable card slots on them. Whereas that right now the cable is generally either 64 QAM or 128 QAM or 256 QAM. The over-the-air is a little more sophisticated, whereas that in the 4K mode it's 2048 QAM and higher. Actually, they're capable of 50-odd megabits worth of throughput, which is phenomenally amazing to stuff in 6 megahertz. Of course, the further away you get from it, the little harder it is if you're going to be picking it up. But it's sort of like digital radio, or HD radio, where it's within 10 or 15 miles of the transmitter, it's the best thing since sliced bread. But once you start getting a little further away from it, you're constantly switching back and forth between 8 and analog. When you get further away from it, your receiver will go to a lower form of QAM because it's all compatible and downward capable, and you'll just have less resolution. So it's an interesting format, and it's going to have its pluses and minuses, just like everything else. So coming, and it seems to be moving at a faster pace now. But for those that don't have receivers that are upgradable, there'll be a little box that you'll plug your HDMI connector into, and you'll plug your antenna into that.
By way of cable, I can see how the people buying these new sets with cable TV, they're probably in pretty good shape. But for a person who is in love with over-the-air broadcast, wants 4K capability, if I understand you correctly, you just told me that 4K over-the-air done with 2048 QAM, in order to get a reasonable bit error rate, I'll bet you that requires 45 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio. Wow. Unless you've got an awful lot of forward error correcting, 45 or 48 dB, whatever the number is, of carrier-to-noise ratio, in order to get a reasonable bit error rate on 2048 QAM. That's a pretty stiff requirement. You better be using a pretty nice antenna with a pretty good altitude.
Yeah, the 4K is only going to need 1024.
Only 1024. Then where is the 2048 required to regard it?
Let me go to 8K.
Now, you're telling me there will be eventually 8K over the air capable resolution.
It's in Japan right now.
That must give you something on that screen that looks better than a 35 millimeter Kodachrome 2 slide. Is that true?
Oh, yes, it does. But move back 20 feet from the screen, and it looks just as good as the 2K that you currently have now.
But 8K, if I'm willing to put my nose up against the screen with 8K, my guess is you're going to see every strand of hair on the head of that personality that's on that screen. Is that true?
No, I saw 8K for the first time a couple of weeks ago. And I'll tell you, it's like looking through a window.
You're telling me you can't even tell that it's television. Are you telling me that at 8K, you can't even see up with your nose against the screen, you can't see the individual pixels? Is that approximately true?
Yeah, you need a magnifying glass if you really want to see the pixels. You know, there comes a point where your eyes can't resolve anything more. I don't know if there be any point in going any further than that. I mean, you've way surpassed the granularity of a motion picture, a 70mm motion picture.
4K is
the thing that's making it look really good beyond the pixels is what we call HDR, or high dynamic range, where that your HD television, and many of them actually don't have it, it's 16-bit deep, whereas that a television is typically 8 or 10 bits deep. Difference in the ability to go from black to white.
Now let me find out about what I think you're suggesting to me when it comes to real world installed adaptability. If the over the air broadcast is 8K 2048 QAM, and because the carrier to noise ratio today, with the multipath and everything else going on, is not required, let me pick a number, 45 dB of carrier to noise ratio. Is the system as proposed with COFDM sufficiently adaptable that I can go down to 1028 or 526 or 256? I can go to a lower QAM rate on that exact same over-the-air broadcast where I don't have as high a requirement for the carrier to noise ratio to get a reasonable bit error rate. Is the system sufficiently adaptable that my receiver can decide to use 64 QAM, 32 QAM in order to get the right carrier to noise ratio, although I'm going to sacrifice something in sensitivity, I'm continuing to get a non-frozen picture. Is the system as proposed going to be that kind of adaptable? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
That's one of the beauties of it. That's built into the standard, just as it is. The receiver is smart enough to know how to adapt itself to what it's picking up.
How far does that adaption go? Will it go down all the way to 4 QAM, 8 QAM, 16 QAM? How far down can it go with a lousy carrier to noise ratio? Go ahead.
Well, the mobile part of it will actually go down to 16 QAM, although they don't expect that to be gauged in terms of, you know, your antenna on the home. But in the mobile environment, it works very, very well.
What limits to how far it can go down? Is the format such that if my receiver had enough adaptability, it could go down to 16 QAM in order to get a non-locked up picture in a really lousy environment where it can now tolerate a hell of a lot of co-channel interference and multipath, for instance. Is the philosophy of operation, if my receiver is sufficiently well designed, that the format will allow that kind of adaptability? Over to you, Eric.
Short answer is yes. Actually, I should send you a white paper on this methodology that they used to get there. But with a lot of thought and a lot of work that went into this, and they were looking at it from multiple points of view. So a multipath, the view of co-channel, and the view of ionospheric tangents, of all things. So, really thought this one out this time.
Was Mr. Spagnoli involved with this new formatting? Question number one. Question number two, once we do all this, and assuming we pull it off and it's successful, will we, for the first time in the last 20 years, we actually have a system of over-the-air broadcast that is essentially superior to what exists in Europe right now? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yes, yes, and yes. The Koreans are already actively using it. They actually started broadcasting nationally, I think it was 2 months ago. And that was incomplete standard. The RF standard has been in place now for quite a while. The back end was under flux in terms of audio, video, format, things of that nature. But that's pretty much stable and solid at this point. So they actually have a real standard that's ready to go.
In the old-fashioned NTSC analog television days, I could set up my scanner so I could listen to the audio subcarrier, audio carrier, all by itself, on my scanner receiver, so I could find out what's going on each of the over-the-air television broadcast channels, sound-wise. With the 8VSB, I couldn't do that. With the new COFDM, must my scanner do a complete demod, or is there a way I could get just the audio into my scanner receiver? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
There's a few receivers out there now that will get you audio from. Remember, we're sending computer data. We're sending packets of data. There's no separate picture carrier or audio carrier in any of this stuff. Stream. And all you need is a big long shift register. Pick out the parts of the stream that you want to listen to. Actually, it's a little more sophisticated than that. You're looking for an ID which says this is an audio packet, or an ID that says this is a video packet. That's how you have all these sub-channels. But you actually don't really have sub-channels. What you're doing is you're telling the receiver, pick out packet number 30, or pick out packet number 40, and grab those and make a PV picture out of it. Actually, it's a little more sophisticated than that, because the packets are 188 bits wide. You have to line them up, and that actually becomes, in the case of 8VSB, an MPEG-2 signal. That has to go into an MPEG decoder, and that's what makes your line-by-line thing. Same thing here. You have a video packet, an audio packet, a data packet, so on and so forth. You pick them out, line them up, and decode them. And in the case of 4K, it's H.267, and there's a couple more standards that include high dynamic range and a few other things. So, same deal, just a lot faster.
So as I sense it, my scanner receiver must demodulate that whole signal as if I wanted to watch the video, and then my receiver must pick out the audio packets that are there. And so there's no advantage of only wanting audio. I might as well get the whole darn thing. So buy a miniature television set and just listen to the audio, so to speak. There's no easy way I can simply add a chip to my scanner receiver and pick out just the audio. I've got to demodulate that whole darn COFDM signal. Although, if I want to do it with a resolution of 16 QAM as opposed to 248 QAM, which it might be capable of, I presume that lowers the carrier-to-noise ratio that my scanner receiver must receive in order to do that demod. Is that approximately true, Eric? T2LIW?
Well, if you want to just suck off audio, the packets don't happen as fast, and it's running at a lower bitrate, whereas the video bitrate might be having video bitrate, say, in terms of 8VSB or just standard 2K, which is HD. Good HD picture really starts at around 12 or 14 megabits, but if you do the whole 18 megabits, which is capable of ESP, you get a much sharper, nicer looking picture. But the audio packets, if you're doing AC3, which is 5.1 sound, the packets are only running at 348 kilobits per second, so you have a difference in speed. So if you're picking up the audio, you've got the advantage of dealing with slower stuff that's coming, and you can also tolerate more errors because of the FEC that's in it.
If I've got a system that's giving me 50 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio, and over-the-air broadcast is now used 8K, 2048 QAM, but I only care about the audio, and my receiver system goes down to, let me pick a number, 16 QAM, and I listen to the audio at 16 QAM versus listening to the audio at 2048 QAM. If I'm a real good hi-fi listener with a well-tuned ear, will I hear a difference in that audio, Eric? K2RIW?
Absolutely not, because the much slower bit rate, you can tolerate the higher signal to noise garbage.
So for the audio I want to listen to in my scanner receiver, I only need the 16 QAM capability. And I think you're saying no adaptable receiver system is likely to go even lower than 16 QAM. Is that true?
No, I don't think that you're going to find anything lower than that. But this is the way the standard is set up. It allows for it, but it ain't. Don't forget, you have to, even though you have multiple carriers, you can actually have in the slower stuff that same information being spread amongst more of those carriers. So, because don't forget, you only send one bit at a time.
Am I correct in assuming that when my receiver is running 16 QAM as opposed to 248 QAM, that a much higher amount of integration is taking place? My noise equivalent bandwidth of my receiver system is a much smaller number when I'm running 16 QAM. I'm really doing a kind of averaging of a lot more bits of the 2048 QAM that's being transmitted. I'm doing some kind of averaging of those, somewhat similar to what goes on with a GPS receiver. Is that roughly true, Eric, K2RIW?
That's the right idea. For the duration of the period of that you're sending the audio packet, you're actually distributing that audio packet amongst more of those carriers. Plus the fact you're doing several types of error correction. You're doing checksums, to put it simply. You're doing Reed Solomon. You're doing convolution encoding. So your chances of recovery of the slower part of the signal is much greater than the video part of the signal.
Fun stuff. Right now, you and I know that particularly on the lower VHF frequencies like channel 2, 4, and 5, pulse noise will be disruptive to a 8 VSB signal. Ignition noise, things like that, and marking of a power line transmission of the power system, your loco, so to speak, is reasonably disruptive. You believe the new ATSC-3 has less of that vulnerability over you, Eric, K2RIW?
No, it has that vulnerability, but to a much lesser degree. Hey, look, do you pick up an ETV at your house, which is, you see it at channel 33, but that's actually VHF-3.
Yeah, that comes through gangbusters all the time. For whatever reason, they must be using a lot of power. I think you're saying that's come from Times Square. And channel 33 to me is a very steady channel. Channel 9.3 and 9.4 are my most troublesome channels. But 33, no sweat. Over you, Eric. K2RIW.
I have problem with RF9 and RF38 also, Dick. I think I told you that already.
Yeah, 31 periodically gives me grief. 31-1234-5-6. And 33, all of the 33s, no sweat. 9-3 and 9-4, a fair amount of grief. But channel 33, is that coming from Times Square, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW?
Yes, sir, that's coming from 4 Times Square, which is lower. And I don't remember what the output power is. I think they were running like GO or the transmitter, something like 20 kilowatts or something like that. Hang on, look it up. My friend Tom, who's up there all the time, he's got those numbers at the tip of his tongue. Like 13, they're hitting now, that CPO is only 4.2 kilowatts. It's nothing.
Yeah.
Well,
Bravo ABC somehow or other managed to get some variances from the FCC, and their TPOs are miles higher, I think they're running like 35 kilowatts, 40 kilowatts. The ERP is way the heck up there. But that's the exception, that's not the rule. As far as like Marion 4 and 3, that's coming off the Fox antenna of Empire. I don't believe they're, I'm not sure if they're on the backfill or not, but 2, 4, which is, you know, they're all UHF. They also have, they're on the backfill antenna, and a lot of us east of the of Empire have real trouble with the inter-symbol distortion there, which they don't really care about, and they hardly believe it, but they know it's there. But if you go north or west or northwest of the state, you don't have any of those problems.
Dick?
Yeah, Joe recognized. Hold on a second there, Joe. So I think you're telling me that my 9-3 and 9-4 difficulty and my 31-all of the difficulties occasionally, one of the aggravating factors is that although it's coming from Empire, the antenna pattern in my direction, because of the backfill antennas, are part of...
Repeater, timeout.
They are part of the reason I'm getting the grief. Whereas 4 times square, channel 33, has a very clean antenna pattern in my direction. Is that part of the reason why I get it so well, KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Yeah, it is. Actually, when they do maintenance, and they turn off the backfill antenna, the stations that you have problems with, all the problems go away for that hour or 2 hours or 3 hours that it's off. I actually, I think it was a year ago, applied the measurements. When the backfill antenna was on, the backfill antenna was off, from right here in Plainview. And the difference is like night and day.
If my television aerial had a rotator on it, and I know that my television aerial has got a complicated pattern on most of these frequencies, fingers all over the place, if I could very carefully rotate it in azimuth, so that the fingers pointed in desirable directions, would my probability of clean reception of 9-3 and 9-4 likely improve, Eric? No, I'm not changing the frequency, I'm just changing the azimuthal pattern. What I'm really asking, I guess, is does the backfill antennas have a slightly different azimuthal pattern compared to the main antenna on 9-3 and 9-4? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
All right, let me point out a couple things first. Is that the two UHF antennas, there's actually three UHF antennas on Empire. One's not being used because that was the old 25 antenna, who now broadcast full-time from 4 times square. And of course, 47, which is NJU, is on World Trade. That should be solid all the time. The intent of the backfill antenna is to cover Brooklyn and Staten Island. And of course, you know, you can't make the beam of that thing narrow that it doesn't head east. A certain amount of mixing that goes on. Backfill antenna has an additional 300 or 400 feet of rigid coax that goes to that antenna. So there's a propagation delay between the main antenna and the backfill antenna. And of course, the bits don't line up with each other. Gives you a hard time. So, but if you could rotate your antenna by just like 1 degree, it'll make a huge difference because of the position of the Fox antenna and the CBS antenna. Plus the fact that those antennas themselves supposedly are designed for wide bandwidth. The wide bandwidth antennas, they handle from channel 40 to channel 20 or whatever it is. And the response to these different channels is somewhat different. They're not exactly the same. That's just the nature of the beast. So you're fighting a couple of issues here.
Yeah, totally true that I've got to add a rotator. To B2LYY, make sure you wait for the beep, sir, Joe. Go ahead, K2LIW.
You know that RF-33 out of Hartford is putting out damn near a megawatt of ERP compared to what you get out of New York City with the scallop pattern of RF-33. I bet it's one of your channels that gives you extra all the time. And the one from channel 9, which is RF-38, there's another transmitter in the east coast of Virginia that I have picked up already. That's the one that I think is giving me accident occasionally now when the band opens up a little bit. Not enough to see it, but enough to wipe out or give you some competition with RF-9 out of, RF-38 out of New York. That's my comment, Dick. And by the way, with the scatter pattern effect, I tried rotating my antenna back and forth, 10, 20 degrees, 5 degrees, makes no difference. When the interference starts coming in, it makes no difference.
You are the south part of the island?
Sure is.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that's why. Come further north, you'll find out that it really does make a difference. You're in a zone where you can wiggle your antenna all you want, and it doesn't really help. There's actually a physical difference where the two antennas are mounted. One's mounted on the north side of the Empire, and the other one's mounted on the south side of the Empire. So, before the backfill antenna actually came up, if you were, say, north of the Hempstead Turnpike, you could have your antenna perfectly pointed and get to 247 at that point, 11 VHF, so 31, a couple of others. That little motion in your antenna, your log periodic, would make a huge difference.
Eric, if they had spent the time, was there the possibility of adjusting the transmission line length such that the backfill antenna on 9-3 and 4, the backfill antenna and the main antenna were perfectly aligned in the time domain? Had they adjusted the transmission line length, could that have been corrected? I know it's going to be difficult, but would that have been possible had that been considered KE2EJ, K2IW?
Yeah, it would have been expensive. And don't forget, the backfill antenna was an afterthought. That came after the first year and a half of operation because nobody could pick it up in Brooklyn.
So in other words, the main antenna on 9-3 and 9-4 was too clean, aimed at the horizon, and the people in Brooklyn were under the umbrella, and so they weren't getting enough signal to noise ratio. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yes, the antenna has the backfill on it. Now don't forget, 9-3 and 9-4 is coming off the Foxman antenna. It has no backfill antenna on it. 9-1, 9-2 is on the CBS antenna. It's a different transmitter.
Wow. So to make the group delay distortions, to make the timing in nanoseconds, picoseconds, come out just right, two different transmitters and two different line lengths and two different exact locations. In other words, the number of feet from the center of the building to the antenna on those two locations, that's also different. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, if you get go to the internet and look at the picture of the top of Empire, you'll see that on the left side there's one what looks like a round pipe. On the right side is another round pipe, and they're not perfectly apart from each other. One is sort of more forward than the other, and they make two completely different patterns. The fact that it says 9-3 and 9-4, it's really Channel 5 transmitter, not Channel 9 transmitter. And then 5-3 and 4 is really Channel 9 transmitter and not Channel 5 transmitter.
Boy, they made it nice and simple. Had we been starting from day one, these numbers could have come out a little more sensible between the brand number and the real RF frequency number. Over to you, Eric.
Well, don't forget, that happened because Fox, or Rupert Murdoch, decided to buy what was RKO General. And when they took them over, since 9 was already in one spot, 5 was in another spot on a different antenna, but they wanted to expand their services, so they put the subchannels of one transmitter on a different transmitter, and they did the same thing the other way. So why exactly they did that, I don't really know what the answer is to that, because they could have put the same subchannels on that same antenna as the transmitter. But I think what it was is that they knew they had the problem between the two different antennas. So if you got one, you didn't get the other, you would still get the services from the one that you didn't get the service from, and vice versa.
Dick, 5-3 is on RF-38, and 9-2 is on RF-44. So if you get those channels in, crappy or good, that's where they're located. All the other channels are on the respective other carriers.
Hey, thank you, Joe. I'm a little bit forgetful. I'm very forgetful, Eric. You sent me an article on it 2 weeks ago. I vaguely remember that the numbers were United States citizens, something like 50 million, as I remember, United States citizens are watching over-the-air broadcast television. I think that was the number, 50 million U.S. citizens. And you have a rough guess as to the New York City metro area, New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, Long Island. In the New York City area, roughly how many U.S. citizens are watching over-the-air broadcast television? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
You know, I should know that number off the top of my head, but I'm going to have to try and extract it from my brain. But I know it's in the order of like 2.5 to 3.5 million, something like that, in the whole tri-state area. It's not a small number.
I'm glad to hear that. Therefore, no matter who becomes the chairman of the Friendly Candy Company, and no matter who thinks that, cable television is so great that we should abandon this old-fashioned thing called over-the-air broadcast, because of all of our legacy, history, and whatever, love of over-the-air broadcast, because of that multi-million number of citizens, I'd like to believe over-the-air broadcast is going to exist for a long time to come. Am I naive on that one? KE2EJ, K2IW?
No, you can't imagine the fights that are going on with a lot of low-power TV operators and stuff like that. When you finally get to middle America, and you get to farmland, the reason why that they're complaining that there's no internet access is simply because there's no cable. There are huge swaths of this country that don't have cable systems, and that's where DirecTV picks up a lot of their subscribers from. But also in the inner cities, for different reasons, you have, rabbit ear type TV operations. So, depends where you look. There's some places where people will spend the money on cable and won't buy food. And then there's the opposite. They won't spend money on cable, but they will buy food. You get the idea.
Okay, so we're always going to have over-the-air cable TV. Anybody have any further questions for our broadcast expert on frequency right now? If not, we're about to go over to the space report. Anybody have any further questions or comments about all of the above? K2LAW and TechNet, we're listening.
Yes, I have a question directly for the broadcast engineer. Did you work for WNET in 1995?
WB2BXO also with a question.
That question was for you, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
I heard if you worked for WNBC in 1995, what was the question?
No, he asked you, did you work for WNET in 1995?
No, actually, in 1995, I worked for one of the largest production post-production organizations in the United States. I worked for a company that we called Unitel Video. We did MTV, we had Jolly Jesse the Show, we had Rush Limbaugh, we did a lot of shows that came out of that place. I was pretty much in the video only, not RF land, so to speak. I went to work for WNET in 96.
Okay, how come you asked that question, Joe? RYY, go ahead.
Very simple, because I wanted to find out the validity of a story I was told by a company that had some equipment on top of the Trade Center, and they had it working in like 1995. They put amplitude companion sideband equipment on top of the Trade Center, and they wondered why it didn't work, and they're trying to get WNET to put a filter, a noise filter, to filter out their sideband noise on the, out on the receive frequency to this equipment. And of course, I said, I don't think the guy's going to do that, because if they're 80 dB down, being that they're over 4 megs away, you're going to lose that fight very quick. So I thought I should ask him to see if he was chief engineer back then, but I guess not.
I can tell you what was at the World Trade Center, if you want to know.
A lot of power coming out of the transmitter on channel 13, correct?
Yes.
Probably a lot of power out of the transmitter on channel 13, and that was a about 200 kilowatts at that time, or 150 kilowatts.
You're saying ERP, or transmitter power output?
ERP. ERP. Combined. Video and audio.
Okay, well, the transmitters were these old RCA transmitters that actually...